Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show for this Medical Monday, May 18th. I'm Lucas Willard, in for Ray Graff today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, where Dr. Soumya Chandra Reddy provides endocrinology care for patients managing chronic conditions such as diabetes and thyroid disorders, nlh.org. Joining us for today's show is Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. Be sure to get your calls in early at 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling and your vascular surgery questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again, and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Lucas Willard, in for Ray Graff. On this Medical Monday, we welcome Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. He specializes in carotid artery surgery, the repair of thoracic and aortic aneurysms, arterial reconstruction of the aorta and peripheral arteries for arterial insufficiency, as well as arterial, venous, and lymphatic therapies. Dr. Darling is a past president of the Society for Vascular Surgery, as well as a past president of the New England and Eastern Vascular and Endovascular Society, a leader in his field. He has lectured on various topics throughout the globe and has authored more than 240 peer-reviewed papers and 150 book chapters. You can give us a call at 1-800-348-2551. Again, the number 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And after that mouthful, Dr. Clement Darling, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I've never met you before, and I know absolutely nothing about vascular surgery. And so I had a little bit of a discussion with my colleagues in the newsroom just a few minutes ago, and we were saying, oh, well, you know, what can I ask the doc about? And vascular surgery is not just related to your blood vessels, correct?
Correct. One of the beauties of what we do is that we do everything with the arteries, veins, and lymphatics from the base of the skull down to the tip of the toes. So we do everything but the heart and the brain. And that, you know, the aorta and the arteries carry the blood away and down to the extremities to nourish the tissue, and veins carry it back, and lymphatics kind of take the slack up between the two. Ironically, you know, we're called vascular surgeons, but you know, if 80% of what we do is see patients in the office and advise them risk factor modification, and we follow them up. We follow our patients pretty much for the rest of their lives if they have significant vascular disease. And only about 20% we intervene on. 80% right now, that's minimally invasive, and the other 20% is open. And it's basically we do vascular medicine with a lot of interventions in between.
Sure. So you've been doing this for a long time. What particularly about it is fascinating to you? Why have you made this your career?
Sure. Again, you know, many surgical specialties, you work in the box in a small, heart surgeons work in the chest. You know, colorectal surgeons work on the large bowel. We get to work everywhere in the body, and we get to do different procedures, and we get to do different approaches, and it's a constantly evolving specialty that allows us to evaluate what works and what doesn't. You know, we try to do as much as we can minimally invasively, but there's still a lot of procedures that need to be done with larger surgeries in order to either stop people from bleeding to death, or save their limbs, or stop them from having strokes. So it's really the variety and the ability to see these patients for their entire life and improve their quality of life.
So when it comes to the minimally invasive surgeries, how has the technology evolved over the last few years? I mean, you've been doing this for 35 years. You were speaking with me before the show. But how has the technology evolved in your time practicing?
It's grown exponentially. Yeah. You know, when I was training, we only did open surgeries. It was long, hard cases. patients had varied outcome. When I first came to this city, 50% of the vascular surgery was done by non-vascular surgeons.
Okay.
So as we kind of perfected what we did here, we were very aggressive about adopting the new technologies as it came through. But I think more importantly, we were very good as physicians at evaluating what works and what doesn't. So we didn't give up what we knew worked in the past, but we also didn't ignore the new technology that was coming from the future. So I think we're constantly evolving and constantly improving. And we do this in a very objective, scientific way.
Wonderful. Well, let's go to the phones. We have Jim from Mount Morris on the line. Jim. Hello, Jim. Jim, do you have a question for the doc? All right. Well, let's move along to Renee in Campbell Hall. Renee, you're on the line. Well, we're having some difficulty connecting to Renee in Campbell Hall right now. We'll bring her back on the phone. 1-800-348-2551 is the number to call, 1-800-348-251. I'm Lucas Willard in for Ray Graff. We're joined today by Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med, and he specializes in carotid artery surgery, the repair of thoracic and aortic aneurysms, arterial reconstruction of the aorta and peripheral arteries for arterial insufficiency, as well as arterial, venous, and lymphatic therapies. Now, I have a question, Doc, because when you're dealing with the circulatory system, and you have both your lymphatic system and you have your circulatory system for your blood vessels, do you see when you are becoming and training and maybe practicing, do you see patterns or similarities depending on whoever you are operating on? If you are looking at the same part of the body from one patient, say they have something that needs addressing in their leg, and then you look at another patient, does it look similar, or is everybody's systems different, or are they built on the same architecture?
Yeah, they're built on the same architecture, but there are variants that one has to recognize. One of the wonderful things about what we do is you have to treat everybody individually, but you have a global understanding of exactly how the blood supply should work and how the lymphatics should work, and then have to address it with each person individually. But you have to know physiology, you have to know anatomy, you have to know the family history, you have to know the variants of each one of those to really give a holistic description to the patient of what they need to do to improve themselves or what we can do to make them feel better or preserve their legs or, you know, stop them from bleeding. You know, the types of diseases we deal with commonly are aneurysms that are outside the brain. They're in the chest, in the abdomen, or in the legs. Blockage, narrowings in the arteries, those have very, each one of those has very similar pathophysiologies that's consistent among people, but who they occur in sometimes is different. And that allows us, you know, that's one of the reasons why it's a long training program to get to where we are. And your learning never stops. Again, knowing all of these problems that can occur in the blood, in the circulatory system, in the lymphatics is important, but it's also knowing how you can, who you should treat and how you can treat. Because just because somebody has a blockage doesn't mean you need to fix that blockage.
Now, why is that?
Because most of these blockages occur over a long period of time, and your body adapts to that. You know, we always, you know, say there's kind of like if I-90 gets blocked off, that there are other pathways around it, like Route 9 or Route 2, that the blood can take.
Okay.
It's when you have acute occlusions, such as when you get in a motor vehicle accidents or an embolus, which is a blood clot that goes from one part of the body to the other. Those need to be dealt with right away, and the body doesn't have time to adapt to them by making an extra circulation or bypass around it. And that's one of the, you know, the hard parts of vascular surgery is, you know, we have to be available 24/7, 7 days a week, not only for the patients, but we also assist a lot of other specialties in their surgeries or their interventions. So we assist a lot of the oncological, like tumor surgeries. We assist the cardiac and cardiologists all the time. And, you know, one of the nice parts about Albany is we work very closely and very congenially with all of our colleagues here, which is very different from where I grew up and trained in Boston.
Well, we'll talk more about Albany in a minute, but let's take a one-minute break for underwriting. We'll be back on Vox Pop with Dr. Clement Darling and your calls after this. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. The number to call is 800-348-2551. That's 800-348-2551. I'm Lucas Willard, in for Ray Graff. And today we're joined by Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. Let's go to the phones. We're going to try Renee in Campbell Hall again. Renee, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hello? Oh, great. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to try hard not to ask a convoluted question. So my left leg was swollen down from the knee to the ankle a year ago. It went away. I then had a stroke in November, which I thank God luckily was very close to a hospital, and I got the TNA blockbuster stuff so that it cleared and I'm perfectly normal. Heart doctor has done a workup on me. We come around to you because the last thing they did was, once again, looking for the swelling in the leg. They did a bilateral LE venous Doppler duplex, whatever. And in that, they found focal segmental deep venous reflux of the left common femoral vein. I met with a vascular surgeon, and he said that the only way to really find out what that is through some really invasive sounding procedure. Is that the only way to find out what is actually leaking or making my leg swollen? How long can I walk around with a swollen leg?
Yeah, it's not 100%. Let's take a step back. Have you ever had any blood clotting problems, or anybody in your family have clotting problems?
No, but they were able to confirm that. Oh no, I have a cholesterol, a liver problem with my cholesterol, but I do not have the blood clotting that they first thought I had, sticky blood, but then they said I don't. They ruled that out.
There are many ways to investigate this. There are some, you know, maximally invasive ways. You can have what we call a venogram, or do an intravascular ultrasound, which are just done through a small needle hole in your vein. Actually, it sounds archaic, but just compression stocks will help the calf pump the blood back up to your heart and try to make up for the laxity in your valve. And that's what most people will do or have done recently. You know, Adriana Laser was involved in a study where we would percutaneously, meaning through the skin, through a catheter, place a valve to replace your old valve, which is what we do sometimes with aortic heart valves. But that hasn't panned as much as we like. I think, you know, we try to treat things like this very conservatively first and not do any invasive procedures. We don't have a good technology yet to replace the venous valves in the legs. But compression stockings actually work equally as well, although in days like this when it's 80 degrees outside, they aren't the most comfortable.
Right. And that's it, just where, as you said, from my toe all the way up to my knee, and I'm fine? That's
yep.
it?
Well, yeah, there are ones that go up to the thigh. Those are a little hard to stay on. Depending on where part of the what part of the femoral vein that's or valves that's not working in that vein, it would depend. Usually it's the calf pump that does 90% of the work. So that's why we just go up to the knee, and you don't have to take them all the way up to the thigh.
Okay. It just sounds so bizarre, but okay, great.
It sounds very archaic, but it actually does work very well.
All right, Ray, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're on the air with Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. Now we're going to try it again with Jim and Matt Morris. Jim, you're on the air.
How fine a suture material can be used in a vascular anastomosis.
Can you ask that one more time, Jim?
How fine a suture material can be used in a vascular anastomosis?
Sure. Well, we usually use somewhere between 6-0, as we call them, proline, which is about the size of your hair. When there's even thinner ones down to 8-0, it depends on where you are in the body. If you're in the aorta, which is a big organ, about a 2-centimeter organ, we use what we call 3-0. Then as you go down to the groin, to the femoral vessels, it's 5-0. And then the knee, around the knee, is 6-0. And then as you go into the foot, it's 7 or 8-0. It's a very fine suture. It does not dissolve over time. Whenever we operate, we tend to use 3.5 power magnification. So it's essentially like under a big microscope. And we have some, you know, we make sure that we can see everything by having a headlight on. So we look a little bit like a robot, but it's worked for us well.
Jim.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Vox Pop on WAMC. Now let's move along to Rudy in Kinderhook. Rudy, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I want to thank Dr. Darling for basically saving my life. I'm shooting way back to 2007. I come in for bypass surgery. I'm on Coumadin, which obviously you have to go off of because I have clotting disorder. And when I went off of it, they bring you on heparin because it's much more fast-acting. Unfortunately, I had a severe reaction to the heparin, and basically everything was shutting down, including my legs, which turned black and everything. Dr. Darling did an amputation below the knee, and thanks to 10 long months in the hospital and that amputation, I've lived to the present day and been able to see my grandchildren. So it's just a big thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to take care of you. You know, I'm sorry you had to lose a leg for this, but, you know, there are, unfortunately, one of the reasons we try to be conservative when we start is to make sure people don't have reactions to medications or complications, although it does occur occasionally. Ironically, our group has been known for being very aggressive about saving limbs and intervening on patients that nobody else feels comfortable taking care of. And that's one of the reasons why we've developed such a big practice. But thank you very much for the kind words, and I'm glad you're doing well and get to see your grandchildren.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Rudy. Thank you for the call. You're listening to Vox Pop on WAMC. Dr. Darling, how often do you get calls or comments like that from patients who say, you saved my life?
Well, you know, one of the benefits, but also one of the challenges of our surgeries or our interventions is that we have the pretty much highest risk patient population in medicine, and we do procedures that require extensive work in the operating room and postoperatively. So I'm giving a talk this week or next week down in Miami about this, and you know, the ruptured aneurysm has about a 50% chance of dying. You know, and that's one of the more common where we do. Second most in the country. You know, limb salvage surgery, where you try to save people's legs because they have gangrene, is a complicated operation, much like the last person who asked the question about the size of the suture. You know, we deal from everything from big arteries to 1-millimeter arteries. So we have to be able to have the technique, the skills. We get called in routinely probably 2 or 3 times a week at night. We always have somebody available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. One of the unique aspects of our system has always been that we have people willing to come in and help if there's more problems or if there are more complicated problems in the operating room, even though you may not be on call. So it's somewhat of a calling to always be available for people that need vascular assistance or patients who need vascular intervention.
For somebody who may suspect that they are experiencing an issue with their circulatory system or their lymphatic system, how important is that to get checked out? Because you had talked about clots that can migrate throughout the body, and you're also looking at, you know, sizes that are down to the size of a millimeter. or a suture that's the width of a human hair. So we're talking about tiny, tiny little clots, potentially up to much larger ones. But when should somebody actually seek help and get treatment if they suspect something's off?
That's a great question. You know, one of the things we do, and again, one of the reasons we don't operate on everybody, and it's actually the minority of patients who we see in the office, is we help people understand their issues, the pathophysiology, and the anatomy of what's going on in their body. And I think assuring somebody that they do not have a limb-threatening or life-threatening problem, I think, is extremely important. And it's much worse for those patients to sit at home and worry about it. So, you know, we again, 80% of the patients we see, we don't operate on or don't intervene on, but it's mostly modifying some of their lifestyle and also getting them to understand what is happening with their body and how they can improve it so that they can have a better quality of life.
Our guest today is Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. This is Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday. The number to call is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Now let's go to Joyce in Brattleboro, Vermont, who's been on the line for a little while. Joyce, you are on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I've recently had a couple of friends on Cape Cod be diagnosed with aortic dissections. And I was wondering whether you could discuss what predisposes people to aortic dissections and if the blood vessel starts to break apart like that, what is the extent to which you could have problems with that?
Well, that's another excellent question. So, you know, nature build you with your blood vessels, which have three layers to them. A dissection is when there's a hole between two of the layers and the blood seeps into that, but does not rupture or go outside the blood vessel. So basically, it makes two pathways. The problem with this is that it can block some of the vital arteries when it does so, and that can give you an emergency. Now, ironically, I have to give another talk on this next week. But the two major type of dissections are what we call type A and type B. And type A is when it happens in your ascending aorta, which comes right off your heart. And that's an emergency that needs to be repaired right away because the mortality gets higher the longer you wait. The more common is what we call a type B dissection, which is it's beyond or distal to your subclavian artery, which is just off the arch of the aorta. Those can be treated medically. There are a few high-risk factors which we keep an eye on, but the vast majority of them we watch as long as you don't have what we say end organ dysfunction, meaning that your blood vessels to your bowel or your kidney or your legs are not getting enough blood. Now, luckily, we have treatment for the type B dissections, which we need to treat, which is more of a stent graft, which is a covered graft that we use and put in the thoracic aorta, and it's much less of an operation than what I was trained at early on, where we'd have to open up the patient's chest and put a tube in there because the blood vessels get very friable with this. So most of these are treated medically for a while, but they have to be watched for pretty much the lifetime of the patient because that wall can degenerate into an aneurysm, and then we need to fix that. I just accepted a transfer about 15 minutes ago while I was waiting.
For this. Okay.
And it's something we probably see once or twice a week. So it's a very common occurrence here. Being from the Cape and from Boston, there are a lot of great surgeons there. The ones on the Cape usually go downtown to Boston to one of the major hospitals. But when the patient has this type B dissection, the most important thing is to control their blood pressure, as we say, impulse control, because what really causes it to get worse is the force of blood coming out of the heart. And so you want to slow the heart down, decrease the blood pressure, and then let the blood vessel heal over time.
All right. Joyce, anything else?
Thank you. And what predisposes people to aortic dissections?
Well, there's
blood vessels. They fall apart, you know?
Yeah. There are people who have uncontrolled blood pressure, especially periodic spikes in their blood pressure are more prone. And that's why we try to keep, you know, when you try to get people to see a doctor, monitor their blood pressure, keep their stress under control. There is a familial predisposition for this in some families, patients with bicuspid valve. Mm-hmm. There's a whole series of anatomic things that go along with this. Patients with Marfan's mm-hmm. disease or some type of collagen vascular disease are much more common to have this. But basically, it's keeping your blood pressure under control for the vast majority of the population.
I have another real quick question.
Sure.
What kind of symptomology do people get if they're starting to experience an aortic dissection?
Yeah, it's, you know, patients always ask, it's about back pain between your scapula, right in the upper part of your back or lower part of your back. And they always say, 25% of the population has back pain, so it's hard to. So people get confused with that, but it's really severe dropping to your knees type of back pain. It's not a subtle finding, as we say.
All right. Joyce, thank you so much for your time. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. That's 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. Our guest today is Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. Now let's go to Robert in Hobart, New York, who's been waiting very patiently. Robert, you are on the air.
Hey, Robert.
Good afternoon. I'm going to be 94 years old in July, and I have an aneurysm in my brain. I was told it could pop sometime, anytime. My problem is, though, that I'm taking Eliquis for atrial fibrillation. And when I go to the doctor, I have swollen feet, but my legs are never swollen. He just squeezes my ankles and doesn't even look at the feet. I'm wondering, is that something I should worry about or not?
Congratulations for being 94, first of all. And
thank you.
Is it? You said he squeezes your feet to look for swelling or just look for the color?
No, my ankles. He just, without taking shoes or anything off, he just squeezes my ankles, said everything's fine. But he never looks at my feet. They're swollen.
Yeah,
I tell him that he didn't pay any attention.
Yeah, well, part of the vascular exam is to always look at your feet and see the color, make sure there are no ulcers there. The reason he's poking your ankles is to see if you have swelling, which can be an indirect sign of congestive heart failure, or some type of heart failure. And I think that's what he's looking at more recently with that. But it is, you're right, it is the best medicine to look at patients' feet just to make sure nothing. That's especially true in the diabetic population because they tend to lose feeling in their feet, and sometimes they'll have ulcers or cuts that they won't notice and will get infected and can potentially
I don't have that.
Limb loss. But it doesn't sound like that's a problem for you.
They look swollen to me.
Yeah, again, the swelling can also be from medication, so it's important, and there's different types of swelling. If you put your thumb on your ankle and it leaves an imprint, that's called pitting edema, and that's probably a little more concerning than just swollen ankles.
Yeah, but it's not my ankles at all. It's just the feet, and they're red, and they look swollen to me.
Yeah.
They don't hurt sometimes.
No,
there's no...
Yeah, that's, it sounds like you have decent perfusion down there, good blood supply down there. And at 94, that's an excellent thing.
All right, Robert, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
All right, now let's take a break. Mr. Mike Bowen will come back with more calls on Vox Pop here on WAMC. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Lucas Willard, pitching in for Ray Graff today. We're joined by Dr. Clement Darling, Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. Now, Dr. Darling, I want to get to some of the questions that have come over email, and you can also send in your questions at voxpop@wamc.org. Eileen writes, good afternoon. Dr. Darling mentioned compression socks. I'd like to hear a little bit more about those. I wear compression socks that I can barely feel on my legs and others that squeeze my legs like a stuffed sausage and one pair that even says it's copper infused. What should they feel like? And are there different tension levels for every day sitting at my desk compared to driving a long distance or air travel? And will any comfortable knee-high socks do just the same? And that's Eileen in Colony.
Hi, Eileen. Excellent question. There are different gradations of the compression socks, and depending on the pathology we're trying to treat. 10 to 15 millimeters of mercury is pretty much the standard one. They go up to 40, actually. I would recommend starting with the lower ones unless you have some significant swelling or significant venous issues. We would much rather have you wear stockings that have some compression than not wear them. And the stiffer ones are harder to get on. There is a device you can use to put them on, but I would recommend only those for people with significant venous disease. The calf pump is what the physiologic function we're trying to improve, and that's why we put them just to the knees for the most part. Regular socks don't work quite as well. You need to have some kind of graded compression, and that's why the 10 to 15 millimeter ones work best. The copper impregnated socks, as it were, have some holistic benefit to them. I can't swear by them. There's not a lot of studies involved with them, but they will help you, and I don't think they will hurt you. But you do need to have at least, and they can buy most of these over the counter now. Some patients whose legs are abnormally swollen, we have them have these stockings made specifically for them also, and usually tell them to get two pairs so they can alternate them.
And we have one more compression sock question, too, over email, sure. Doc. So Joe writes, I wear thigh-high compression stockings. I'm flying to Europe in June. I'll be traveling for 24 hours plus. Is it harmful to wear my stockings from 8 a.m. to nighttime of the next day?
The main reason not no the answer simple answer is no, it's not harmful. The trouble is they do get a lot of moisture underneath them, and you can get some maceration of your of the skin of your feet. So it would be nice to take them off at some point. I know it's difficult, it is impossible to do it in a plane. So I think it's not going to hurt you. You'll probably get more benefit from having them on than not having them on. But I would make sure as soon as you can just to, wipe your legs dry, put some powder on them so they don't become macerated.
That's Dr. Clement Darling there on the Vox Pop here. It's Medical Monday. I'm Lucas Willard in for Ray Graff. The number to call is 800-348-2551. That's 800-348-2551. Now we have Jan on the line in Latham who's been waiting. Jan, you're on the air.
Well, hello, Dr. Darling. I'm a patient that had some vascular issues, all peripheral in my calves, and actually did a bout of Eliquis short term just to treat it. Now I use compression socks all the time. They're probably in that 10 to 15. But now my feet have some numbness started. I've seen my endocrinologist. She doesn't believe I have diabetes. I've seen the back guy, he said the numbness is not from that. So there's all these things. Can the socks actually cause some nerve damage?
Not commonly. There is a superficial saphenous nerve which runs right anterior to your ankle that sometimes can get compressed with the socks, which gives you more of a shooting pain than a numbness pain, but it does can give you some numbness. When you have, I wouldn't say complications, but when your socks bother you, elevation works equally as well. And so, we always tell people to take short, frequent walks and then try to elevate their legs. And so if, you're having some numbness or being uncomfortable with the socks, it's best to take them off and just keep your legs at the level of your heart or as high as you can by putting them on a chair or a recliner in order to do it. Yes.
And they also are doing some B12 investigation to see if I'm actually absorbing it and using it. So that nerve damage from B12 deficiency, is that true?
Sure, deep.
Say that one more time, Jen.
From vitamin B12.
Oh, vitamin B12.
Deficiency.
Yes, actually, there's some of the antioxidant drug medications are good. B12's good. You know, sometimes even massage and is good, especially for lymphatic problems in the lower extremities. So, all of those things, you know, I think can be valuable. You know, you really should go through your family practitioner. They should know the medications you're taking, just to make sure that there's no complications with any of them.
Jan, thanks so much for calling.
And
let's move it along now to Bessie in Albany, who's on the line. Bessie, you're on the air with Dr. Darling.
Good afternoon, Dr. Garland.
Afternoon.
Bessie, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I wanted to know, how do you treat cancer?
Question is, how do you treat cancer? Do you deal with cancers when you are your field of vascular surgery?
One of the things we've learned, you know, in cancer surgery, it's always a challenge because what you're trying to figure out what's resectable and what's not resectable and what kind of other therapies can go along with you to clear you from cancer. So the cancers that we tend to be involved with are renal cell cancer, which is kidney cancer, because that tends to grow inside the blood, inside the vena cava. And so when we have to open the vena cava to pull the tumor out, we get involved with that. More recently, also, a lot of pancreatic cancers grow right next to the blood vessels, the portal vein and the superior mesenteric artery. And so in order to minimize the length of the surgery, we get involved by being able to dissect around that. You know, we're kind of plumbers, and some people don't like dealing with blood vessels or things around the blood vessel, so they call us in to minimize the blood loss during the operation, minimize the operative time, and be able to resect some of those, part of those veins if we need to clear you of the cancer. So we aren't actively directly involved in the cancer therapy. We're there more as technicians to try to make sure all the cancer gets removed.
Removed surgically?
Move safely, yes.
All right.
I didn't say safely.
Oh, what
I
did you say?
Surgically.
I'm sorry.
Surgically.
Surgically, yes. You know, a lot of cancers can be treated, with chemotherapy or radiation. And sometimes we do that. They do that before the operation to shrink the tumor to make it easier for all of us to resect the tumor.
And Bessie, thank you much for calling.
But how much?
Oh, I'm sorry, 1-800-348-2551. Let's move along to Jennifer in Orange County. We got a lot of people on the line. Let's move on to Jennifer in Orange County. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm 58 years old. January 1st, 2022, I suffered a brain bleed at the base of my brain. And I was in ICU for 2 weeks. Everything turned out okay. Now, they also told me that I had suffered at least two strokes, small strokes, which I have no idea that I had suffered. I don't know when they happened. But my father also had an abdominal aneurysm. Is any of this hereditary, or is there anything I should be looking for?
Sure. I'm glad you're doing well. This sounds like very serious problems. 20% of people have a genetic predisposition for aneurysms. What we recommend is usually around 60, that if you do not have that, get an ultrasound of your aorta, and you can see if your aorta is grown or big. There is really no correlation between abdominal aneurysms and intracerebral bleeds or aneurysms, although except for some thoracic aneurysms. So unless you have a first-degree relative that's had an aneurysm, the chances are low. You know, aneurysms occur as people get older. So most of the patients we operate on or intervene with are 72 years old. That's the average. And it takes a long time for these aneurysms.
Yeah, he was about 74.
Yeah, so it's...
He was about 74 when he had his abdominal.
So if you have one, and if you're getting close to the to Medicare age, actually at 65, there's a thing called the SAVE Act, which allows you to get screened for abdominal aortic aneurysms if you're in a high risk group. If your brother had an aneurysm, I think you probably would be wise to get an ultrasound of your. It's a very simple, non-invasive.
It was my father.
Your father?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's still, it's a first degree relative. So. I think it would be it would be important to get the screening just to make you feel better. You don't need, if it's normal, you probably don't need one for the rest of your life after that, or at least 5 years, wait 5 years to get it done, because it takes a long time for these aneurysms to grow.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jennifer, thank you for calling. The number to call is 800-348-2551, and we're on the air with Dr. Clement Darling, who is Chief of Vascular Surgery at Albany Med. We're joined now by George in Johnstown, who's been on the line. George, you're on the air.
Hey, George.
Yeah, hi. I have a 100% blockage of the left carotid artery and a 50% blockage in the right. And every time I go in, they check, and then they not seem to be doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question out of their mouth is, have you had another stroke? I'd like to know, at what level am I going to be able to get surgery to clear it up, or is it too dangerous to do, or what?
That's another very good question. So when your carotid artery blocks off completely, a third of the people have a big stroke, a third of the people have a minor stroke, and a third of the people have no symptoms. Luckily, you fell into the latter group. The other side, you know, usually we wait till the arteries are 70% narrowed before we intervene, and that's just because, unfortunately, there are some risks involved in doing these operations. You know, we still do most of these with what we call a carotid endarterectomy when we need to get it done. We do also some carotid artery stents, which actually work reasonably well, too. But we usually like to wait till they're 70. Now, one of the other issues is the ultrasound is a little bit not unreliable, but tends to overread what you have. One side that's blocked and the other side is open, because your other carotid artery picks up some of the slack because of the blockage in your other artery. And in the brain, there's a crossover where the artery on the left side, where one side can nourish the other side also, because it's one big pathway. So usually we wait till you're 70% narrowed, or if you have symptoms, and the symptoms can be anything from like a shade coming down over your eye, or a weakness on your arm or leg, or trouble speaking. All those are consistent with mini strokes, as it were. You know, then this is all based on many of the studies. This is one of the, you know, most studied vascular process that we do. So we usually wait till 70. We don't jump in at 50. Unless you have a symptom.
Even though one side is blocked entirely.
Yep. Sounds crazy. I understand. But this, you know, we've done over 17,000 carotid operations since I've been around here at Albany, or in our group. And so we've seen a lot of the disease, and it doesn't sound logical, but that's what science has told us.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. All right, George, thanks for calling. 1-800-348-2551 with Dr. Clement Darling of Albany Med. And now let's go to Elizabeth, who's on the line from New Paltz. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Elizabeth.
And Elizabeth, hi, if you wouldn't mind just turning your radio down or your speakerphone down.
Okay, I had it on speakerphone. I'm in the car. Okay, I'm on regular. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yep. We can. Yep.
Okay. If I have pulsatile tinnitus, and they said that I had left venous stenosis, empty cella. I understand you could get a stent put in for that.
Yes, you can. Have you had any symptoms besides the tinnitus?
Mostly that.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear it constantly. So in order to go to sleep at night, I listen to podcasts of Vox Pop.
Yeah, again, it's important to look at the anatomy. Some of that is because your artery becomes elongated and, you know, circuitous, kind of like a pig's tail, and that's what gives the velocity changes that gives you the hearing changes. We don't usually consider that.
I was told that it was from, I forgot what the word is, that when your heart beats, it the movement of the blood, actually, you hear it.
Correct. No, that's exactly right.
With
that's just
heartbeat.
What we call, well, we, you know, there's...
Turbulence, that's the word, turbulence.
Turbulence, exactly. And what that is nature makes you with nice, straight, cylindrical tubes, and blood flow is what we call linear, meaning the blood flow goes right through the middle of those tubes. When your arteries become, you know, they become angulated or curly-cue, that gives them a lot of turbulence in there, which then that's what you hear, especially when it's close to one of the bony, like there's a syndrome called Eagle syndrome where you can get it in one of the process of your neck. And when as the blood whooshes through there, you'll get the whooshing tinnitus kind of sound. We usually don't operate on patients for that, although in extreme circumstances we do, and it depends on how much narrowing is seen in the blood vessel. But it's kind of a natural progress as people get older, their blood vessels tend to elongate and become curlicue-like, and it can't happen in the neck. There is an operation we can do which straightens it out, but we'd obviously have to see you and talk to you about that before we do it. I wouldn't jump into it unless you really were completely disturbed by this and it was bothering you. But I'd have to look at your anatomy to give you a better idea of what we should do.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Elizabeth. Now we have time for one more question. That let's go to the email, Doc. This is from Barbara, who very quickly, I just want to get through this email here. The last ultrasound for my fibromuscular dysplasia I had in March 2026 of my carotid arteries showed 50 to 69% blockage, which increased from 40% a year and a half ago. I am a female, 70 years old. Will this continue to progressively get worse? And if yes, at what point is surgery done and what does it entail? And that's from Barbara.
Great. That's a challenging problem. FMD or fibromuscular dysplasia is more common in women and younger women. It happens in the renal artery and the carotid. We used to do serial dilatation through a surgical procedure. Now we use balloons to do it. Usually we wait till it's either symptomatic or above 70%. We would corroborate your ultrasound with a CT scan in order to make sure that what the anatomy looks like and if it's really as tight or as narrow as the ultrasound says. It's difficult sometimes for the ultrasound to really get all the velocities correctly. That's why we like to corroborate it with a secondary test.
I think we have time for one more quick question. Sure. Over email. This is a question from Catherine. My doctor diagnosed venous insufficiency in my legs. What is it and how is it treated?
So venous insufficiency is when your valves in your veins, whether they're superficial or deep, are not working correctly. So when you stand up or when you stand up, the hydrostatic pressure is higher and the blood tends to pool in your ankles. As I said in the earlier questions, that's why the calf pump or using compression stockings help override the valvular insufficiency and bring that blood back to your heart. In some cases, if your superficial veins are not working well at all, we can what we call ablate them, or Dr. Laser in our office uses a radio frequency or a laser to do that, and that's just an outpatient procedure. If you have peripheral vascular disease, we try to avoid that because we use that vein sometimes for bypasses. But venous insufficiency just means your valves are not working in your lower extremities.
And we're just about out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in and apologize to everyone left on the line. I'd also like to thank Dr. Clement Darling of Albany Med for joining us today on Vox Pop Medical Monday. Support comes from Stinging Nettle Botanics, Main Street in Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. Stinging Nettle NY. Thanks again for joining us on Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Mr. Mike Bowen. Jim Mountier took your calls. I'm Lucas Willard in for Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we welcome back Rensselaer County historian Kathy Sheehan. That's tomorrow at 2 o'clock today on Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for the best of our knowledge here on WAMC.